Welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Finsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a place that brings together people passionate about positive impact. Today's episode is a little different from our usual format. We recently held a live event at The Conduit called Unraveling the Iranian Crisis, where an expert panel delved into the geopolitical consequences of the latest events in the Middle East. I was joined in conversation by Christian Amanpour, chief international anchor for CNN and host of CNN International and PBS's nightly interview program, Amanpour. Dr. Sanam Vakil, deputy director and research fellow for the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. And Eli Geranmaya, senior policy fellow and deputy director of the Middle East and North Africa program at the European Council on Foreign Relations. I kicked off the panel by asking Eli and Sanam to provide an overview of the Iran nuclear deal, otherwise known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for the invitation. So, the nuclear deal took over 10 years to negotiate. That's an important point. It's far more than a deal about Iran's nuclear program, but it was actually instigated by the fact that many of the world powers were concerned that Iran's expansion of its nuclear program could trigger a military conflict, either because of U.S. military strikes against Iranian nuclear facilities or, in fact, an Israeli military strike. And so there was an option put on the table, particularly under the Obama administration, but as I said, the negotiations began before that, to actually try and contain the nuclear program and reach some sort of a understanding between Iran and the world powers regarding the future of this program, to ascertain that it was primarily and exclusively for civilian use. Now, the nuclear agreement itself is one of the most impressive multilateral agreements of arms control. Iran, because of this deal, is now the most heavily inspected country in the world by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And the deal has managed to, despite the cracks, the deep cracks that have emerged under the nuclear, under the Trump administration, the deal has still managed to ensure that there are inspectors on the ground watching what Iran does and being able to report back to the world the extent to which its nuclear activities are expanding or not. And I think that the main issue at play right now is the world safer with this deal in place or with the major cracks and potential collapse that we're seeing now because of the U.S. policies? I work a lot on European foreign policy on Iran, and the Europeans, the Russians, and the Chinese maintain that actually the world is safer with this agreement in place, and actually the Trump administration has not managed to put on the table a viable alternative to move towards if this deal collapses.
So if you were to have the most fair-minded and objective assessment or rejection of that deal, what would be the rejection?
Sure. Thank you, Paul. And it's a pleasure to be here with you all this morning. To be balanced, while the JCPOA was an accomplishment and a multilateral accomplishment at that, that goes far beyond Iran and the P5 plus one, there are problems with the JCPOA, and those problems were very evident from even before the JCPOA was concluded. The JCPOA was limited in its scope and scale, frankly, because Iran has not been isolated solely because of its nuclear program, but because it has a very activist regional foreign policy, which is self-imposed, and it's a policy that it has defended for 40 years, directed to pushing out the U.S. From the Middle East to protect its own interests. And it has pursued that policy by interfering in countries around the region. It has supported non-state actors or proxy groups. In Lebanon, it has helped to create Hezbollah. It has supported Bashar al-Assad's regime. helping it to survive the civil war and come out far ahead, although that conflict is far from over. It has created popular mobilization units known as the Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq. And those groups were useful in fighting against ISIS, but now pose a threat to the sovereignty and the functioning ability of the Iraqi government. And also, it has done the same in Yemen's conflict, supporting the irredentist group, the Houthis. Iran is an opportunistic state actor that takes advantage of weak states in order to further its foreign policy. So the Trump administration took on Iran in order to redress the imbalance with the JCPOA, which only dealt with the nuclear issue and didn't address Iran's regional role. And in addition to the foreign support of groups outside Iran's borders, Iran also has a ballistic missile program that was not included in the JCPOA. And that ballistic missile program is not just about Iran's defensive purposes. It also proliferates ballistic missiles outside of Iran and gives them to non-state actors in the region. So you can imagine from the perspective of course, the Trump administration, but also many European countries, including the E3, who share these concerns, that Iran is a destabilizing force in the region. It is not the only destabilizing force, but it is a destabilizing force. So the Trump administration withdrew from that deal with the objective of renegotiating a better deal. We're nowhere near to that end game, but that was the plan.
So, Christian, you have watched and commentated on both diplomacy, conflicts, and wars in many years. And to the extent that diplomacy is the art of the possible and seeks to achieve what can be achieved based on both a balance of power in any context and what the multilateral engagement partners are willing to agree to, when you step back and look at the Iran deal, how should we be thinking about it? A good first step, something to be built on incrementally, something that is fatally flawed, because it really does set the context for the next phase and the escalation that we're about to discuss.
So as a journalist, it's actually really difficult to cover this country, and it's very difficult to cover this geopolitical structure of it, because no matter what you say as a journalist, and no matter the depth of experience and, having been there and seen it and talked to people over certainly the last 20 years in Iran, from the presidents on up and down, no matter what you say, you're accused by one side or the other of taking sides. So that's a big problem with the whole Iran problem, because it is such a live object of distrust, hatred, even for analysts, even for governments. Nobody quite knows how to grapple with this country. So all I can say is that forever we have been told as a world that the most significant threat to the world is an Iran military nuclear program. Apparently George Bush told that to President Obama when they had a transition before Obama came into the White House. And Obama took it seriously and built on, as you correctly say, the previous 10 years of attempts to get Iran somehow, to come in from the cold on its nuclear program. The first time this was possible was during the reform administration of Mohammad Khatami, who I covered and who used his position, and Rouhani was his national security advisor. They tried to offer something to the United States, and President Bush famously put it into a drawer and it never went anywhere, and then he called them the Axis of Evil, and we got Ahmadinejad, and on and on and on. So just the layers of distrust and difficulty in trying to even gather this, trying to even make any kind of policy. So then they do it, the Obama administration comes in, they have Oman, they have, sort of secret back talks and this and that, and it turns into the JCPOA. So to me, it seemed that if that was identified by the world, including the Israelis, including the neocons in the United States, including Europe, everybody thought this was the worst problem that could happen, Iran with a nuclear weapon, well, boom, there you go. You've sorted it for the time being. And in diplomacy, I gather, not that I'm a diplomat, that it is the art of the possible and not the art of the perfect. So the problem with the people who dislike this deal is that they, A, have no alternative, and B, conflate perfect with good. So they make perfect the enemy of the good. And that's a real problem, because when you throw a deal that has been negotiated, you know, for so many years, I mean, we remember, right? I mean, how many, at least 2 years, John Kerry and Javad Zarif were, you know, back and forth, back and forth. You had all the European counterparts involved as well. It took a long time. It was hundreds of pages, this deal. And as you point out, it is now the most observed program in the world. So the question is, who has a plan and a strategy, and what is it? And that, to me, is the biggest question and the biggest impossibility of dealing with this, because I don't know whether the United States actually has a plan and a strategy. Because even, let's go post-Obama, because their plan was to ring-fence this program. Now, Trump has pulled out of it. But what's the alternative? He says he wants a deal.
Right.
But how? And then Pompeo and that lot say, well, actually, we want regime change. I mean, from both sides of his mouth, on the day after the killing of Qasem Soleimani, Pompeo said, on the one hand, this, and on the other hand, that. People didn't know what the administration was saying.
So Eli, give us a sense. We have a sense of the pros and cons of the nuclear deal. We have a little bit of a sense of the context. Give us the best account of what you think the Trump administration's project is with Iran. If you're going to tear this deal up, what is the goal, and how are they going about doing it to the extent that there is a grand vision and a strategy?
So I've tried for the past 3 years to answer this question, and I don't think I've come up with a definitive answer. And I think part of the problem, as Christian alluded to, is that we're getting competing narratives from different personnel within the U.S. administration. And as this personnel, the men that circle President Trump have changed, that narrative has also changed as well. President Trump himself has consistently said he wants to undo the terrible Obama deal and stamp it with Trump and have a new deal with Iran. And there was a sense, I think, in the early part of his administration, even in Tehran, that maybe a deal could be done with President Trump. But then as soon as John Bolton came into the White House, the U.S. withdrew from the nuclear deal. And then you had essentially an oil embargo being imposed on Iran, and that completely changed the narrative. And John Bolton is a man that has dedicated his career to regime change in Iran. So the sense was that that point when John Bolton came in and then all of the so-called adults around the president left, which was, you know, General Mattis, previous Secretary of State Tillerson, there was no moderate voice that would actually push towards a diplomatic pathway with Iran. So what we have now, instead of a so-called carrot and stick approach, is bashing with the stick and no diplomatic off-ramp. And so my sense at the moment, particularly with the position taken by Secretary of State Pompeo, who's an incredibly influential figure in the system on Iran, is that they're looking for disruption of the Iranian state. And if it collapses, it collapses. That's not a real area of concern for the United States.
So Sanam, in some ways, you could sort of analogize by saying, look at the way Trump or his administration negotiates NAFTA or trade deals with China. In some ways, you say, I'm going to blow up a deal and then I'm going to renegotiate it and put it in. In some ways, it's kind of real estate negotiations that occurs. You know, I don't like your deal. We'll go higher. We'll go lower. Let's do a longer lease. Let's do a shorter lease. Let's get a better deal. And so is the right way to think about this seeking to tear up an old deal and replacing it with something else? Or is it seeking to have no deal at all and in fact destroy your adversary? Because in a way, those are two very different paradigms, and they have very different consequences for both how the negotiations are conducted or whether you in fact want negotiations at all.
I think the Trump administration is definitely in disarray. I mean, just to echo the sentiments, I'm just back from Washington, and every time we go, it's really reinforced that the right hand and the left hand don't talk, the fingers don't even move together. And thereby, it's very hard to see how the Trump administration wants to play this out. There are also challenges, obviously, domestically in the U.S. with impeachment. I mean, there's a lot of noise that is blocking this Iran issue from moving forward. We've had ebbs and flows to the process as well over the past few months. I think our analysis of this problem does change. In November of last year, there were protests in Iran that were very brutal. The government cracked down, arrested thousands of people, killed reportedly hundreds of people. That changed the prism for Washington's perception of its policy. Then came the killing of Qasem Soleimani that emboldened Washington further. So Washington right now is looking at maximum pressure as being very effective, maybe not to facilitate a deal right now, but perhaps to weaken Tehran. They see that the regime is back-footed. They know that Tehran is more constrained and can't necessarily react in the same ways. But at the core problem is that the Trump administration, but I think generally the American bureaucracy doesn't understand the worldview in Tehran, how the Iranian political establishment thinks. They don't understand the history, the impact of an 8-year war from 1980 to 1988, that it's created a paranoid political establishment that, you know, ultimately seeks to preserve the Islamic Republic for as long as possible. And so they're looking at case studies around the world. The INR treaty with Russia, for example. They're looking at where the U.S. withdrew just recently. So a treaty isn't necessarily even permanent. They're looking at the deal with North Korea that hasn't really come to fruition. They're looking at the Trump policy to Venezuela that also hasn't resulted in any win for the Trump administration. And Tehran is looking at these case studies and trying to hedge its bets and seeing out to play things out over the coming year, really.
So, Christian, you woke up one morning preparing for your show, or occurred late at night, and to discover the news of the targeted killing and assassination of Qasem Soleimani. And it clearly has inserted yet another element of uncertainty into an already very, very volatile situation. And so, based on your years of experience, when that happened, how big of a deal did you think that was? And give us a little bit of a sense of, if roles were reversed, who in the US or the UK would have been assassinated? Who is the analog to this man?
Well, I ain't going there, because if that happens, I'm going to be blamed. So, suffice to say, though, I think everybody believed that the small barrage of missiles that was directed from Iran into an empty parking lot, so to speak, that did not kill anybody, although it did cause some injury to some personnel there, was incredibly restrained. I think, you see, again, because it's such an issue that nobody quite understands, I think everybody thought World War III was going to break out. I think most analysts who kind of knew and watched the program in Iran and watched, you know, the United States over the last 40 years felt that several things might happen in response. There would be a response, as they telegraphed, and this is what it was. And actually, Javad Zarif was telegraphing from the very beginning that we will respond proportionately. He went on CNN to give an interview just to say that. You know, they were sort of lowering expectations for how they were going to respond. The United States immediately, and I know this from, I mean, you've probably talked to various diplomats as well, engaged its allies in the region and in Europe to try to tell Iran, this is all we're doing, do not respond any, you know, heavily, we're just going to, you know, they tried to get Iran to de-escalate literally as they sent the drone strike over that killed Qasem Soleimani and the head of the Baghdad or the Iraqi proxy forces there. The Swiss were the back channels to tell Iran. And apparently, the minute Iran programmed their response, it went to the Swiss, to the US, and that was it. You know, and that's why, do you remember Trump said, all is well? That was the first thing he did before we knew exactly the extent of the Iranian reprisal. So weirdly, even in this weird, strange, you know, targeted killing environment, there was a channel of communication that kept the lid on what could have been a much worse thing. I think some of us, I mean, certainly I know what I said on the air. I said that what will happen is that the Iranian establishment, also the supreme leader, will, and he said it, so we took him at his word, we will respond proportionately. These missiles are not our only response. Our response is to get rid of the United States from the region. Well, you don't do that by missiles. You do that from a long-term policy. You try to get them out of Iraq. You try to move them as far away from your border as possible. And I think that's still their strategy. Whether or not it's ever possible, I don't know. But right now, you know, you have a President Trump who also wants to pull back from that region. That's why this whole thing is so difficult to analyze, because Trump also wants to pull back. The Iranians want, you know, the U.S. out of that area. So it's all happening at a very, you know, bizarre time. But they probably will. I think most people feel that there'll be a series of potential tit for tat, trying plausible deniability. But my question actually, you know, is, can Iran get away in this atmosphere with plausible deniability? Because anything that happens will be blamed on the regime in Iran, even if it's a proxy in Baghdad or Yemen or wherever it is. And secondly, those who like to say we're winning and losing, some have said that Iran's response shows that Iran is a paper tiger. Now, I don't know what they were expecting. Were they expecting Iran to come out and confront the most mighty military in the world head on? Or what? But I mean, obviously, that's not going to happen. Iran is never going to take on the military of the United States. It's an asymmetric conflict. So we have to see whether that progresses. But I think that, you know, this is probably not over yet. And I think the big dilemma for all of us and all of you is, does the United States have a plan? The question really is, what is your strategy, sir? What is your strategy, sir? What is your strategy, sir? Because if the strategy is to let Iran collapse, let's say, as option B, well, then we have a history to tell us what that'll look like. That's what happened in Iraq. After the Gulf War of 1990-91, the UN imposed massive sanctions on Iraq to make sure that they had no nuclear program going forward. And it was horrible. It was sanctions that not just stopped the nuclear program, but slowly killed the people and destroyed every piece of infrastructure in that country, from electricity to water to medicine to food, hospitals. It was destroyed. So that when George W. Bush came in on March, whatever it was, 17th, 2003, it just fell like that overnight. There was no resistance. And what was the result? It wasn't a good result, because the people and the country was devastated. So even if they'd been glad to see the end of Saddam Hussein, they had no basis upon which to rise up and you know, have a solid functioning, not just democracy, but an infrastructure, a nation. And 20 years later, we're dealing with what happened, US policy towards Iraq. If the United States believes that maximum pressure to destroy Iran to the point of regime change, and if it's a nation that's completely destroyed of 80 plus million people, well, they better have a plan. They better care what happens, because you're going to have this mess in that part of the world. And it's going to, what do we have from, you know, the war in Iraq brought us ISIS, you know, brought us AQIM, or, you know, all these other things, brought us refugees. We are still paying for what happened in Iraq, because there was no proper post-war plan. And that's what I worry about in Iran, that they don't have a plan. And if it's regime change, they don't even have a plan to contain that. And by the way, they can bomb a bit, but can they bomb Iran into smithereens? I'm not sure they can.
So Ellie, let's pause and say, let's zoom back, as Krishan asked us to do, from the tit for tat, who gets assassinated, which car parks get bombed, how the kind of, you know, short-term reprisals works, and look at this in a more kind of medium-term context, and give us a little bit of a sense of who wins and who loses, because I think sometimes we have two levels of analysis. One is a kind of geopolitical and regional analysis of who gets strengthened and who loses as a result of this recent escalation. But from the perspective of the Iranian people, right, if your project is a democratic, rights-respecting Iran in which women are treated fairly and Iran plays a constructive role in the region, how is the balance of forces shifted here by the recent escalation?
Sure. I'm going to answer your question with a prelude, which is essentially that if you go back to May of last year, when the U.S. sanctions against Iran's energy sector came in, Iran essentially was under what it called an economic state of war with the United States. And so from May, within every 1.5 months, 2 months, something was going pop in the region. And this is even before the events around Qasem Soleimani. So my expectation for the medium term is that we are currently in a period of cooling off, but that inevitably something is going to go pop in the coming weeks, because this current situation for Tehran is unsustainable. It wants to change the calculations for the Trump administrations. And it could go in multiple directions as we head closer towards the November elections in the US. Iran could either ramp up or ramp down. And my sense that is that, as Christiana said, it will look to go back to its conventional methods of plausible deniability, but it's going to be much more difficult to assert that under the current circumstances. But speaking to Iranian officials, it's clear that they are prepared. They don't want this, but they are prepared to take hits from the United States in return. So what I'm trying to say is that in Iran right now, at least at the political leadership level, there is a mentality of we are at war with the United States, but not in the conventional military way. So what does that do to the politics in the country? Well, I think we're already seeing it. It's shifting to the right. You have parliamentary elections coming up in a few weeks in Iran. First of all, the voter turnout is expected to be extremely low because people have just stopped participating in politics. There is a widespread sense of hopelessness at the current situation and the options available to them. Secondly, many of the figures in the reformist so-called factions have been disqualified. And so they're being pushed out of politics. And that's primarily because their project was very much linked to the Rouhani administration, which was, we will deliver on the economic needs of the people through the nuclear deal. And they have utterly failed on that because of the actions of the United States. And so they are essentially that pro-diplomacy, pro-engagement faction in Tehran is being increasingly sidelined. And my sense is that we are going to see the emergence of a much more hardline control of the executive branch in Iran, of the parliamentary branch. We already have hardline control in the judiciary and the security. And what's important is that in the next presidential elections in Iran, which is in 2021, it's not that far away, there are expectations that within that term or the second term of that presidency, the issue of succession of the supreme leader will also be decided. And so if you have majority centers of power in the hands of hardliners, you can guess which trajectory that succession issue is also going. So my sense as we see it today, and again, Iran is a country that is extremely hard to predict, and there can be many wild cards in there. But the trajectory right now is that if indeed the United States is going to negotiate with Iran, it's going to negotiate with a much more hardline political establishment.
So, Sanam, if your project from the US perspective is to embolden and empower a set of hardline actors who continue to make your case that this is a group of people who can't be trusted and who should be obliterated, then in some ways, this action makes in its own way sort of sense, right? What you do is you sideline the moderates and reformists, the people who were interested in seeing an economically viable Iran in the region, and you strengthen a group of people who have bad PR and who comport with a kind of pre-existing stereotype of what this regime is like. Leave aside for a moment Krishan's point of once you're a dog chasing a bus, once you catch the bus, which is remove that regime, you don't know what to do. But if your project is removing a regime, this in fact may suit both the hardliners and the US and remove moderates and kind of the democratic impulses of the Iranian people. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, I think it is a relatively fair assessment. But I think the problem here, again, is that the Trump administration and actually the whole U.S. foreign policy establishment just operates, again, in a different prism. It's a four-year cycle. There's no long-term strategic policy. Iran has a long-term strategic policy. I've mentioned it to them on multiple times. You're really emboldening hardliners in Iran. You're giving the regime a new lifeline and not for the better. You are disenfranchising Iranian people. You are pushing out the moderate voices. But frankly, I think that particularly within the Trump administration, they don't believe in the moderate voices. They don't think that they are people that can bring about transformation or change in Iran. And I've heard from a number of people that they much prefer to deal with the people that can make decisions. So in their mind, it would be better to sit down, if and when it ever comes to fruition, with hardliners, because they are the ones that can rebalance.
Qasem Soleimani, the guy they just killed.
Exactly. Rebalance, reassess Iran's foreign policy. So they don't see it that way. And I think, you know, they're not thinking about the longevity of the Islamic Republic, ultimately speaking.
I mean, we sort of joked, but the fact of the matter is, just so that you know, who was Qasem Soleimani? Obviously, he was a young man during a teenager or whatever, during the first Iran-Iraq war. He fought very heroically. Then he rose up through the ranks. And became who he became, the leader of the expeditionary forces of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and became very popular and a little bit culty after the rise of ISIS in Iraq, when he, basically, I say it in shorthand, he and his proxy forces stood between ISIS in Mosul and Baghdad. Essentially, that's what happened in the summer of 2014, right? But beyond that, he actually did, in a way, have dealings with the United States, because it was Qasem Soleimani, Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, the leaders at the time, who realized that after 9/11, there was a common cause, and that was Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. So they actually did, without shaking hands and kissy-kissy, they did actually work together in Afghanistan and then to an extent in Iraq before it became strategic competition. So it's not facile to say Qasem Soleimani, though that is the person. If you want to make a deal between two real estate brokers, two hardliners, it's Trump and Qasem Soleimani, but they killed him. So again, what is the plan? What is the plan? I mean, that's the hardest thing. And I just would say one thing on behalf of the Iranian people, because we forget, you know, this is not just a country that we don't like. It's a country full of really incredible, smart people. And it is the only country in the Middle East where the people support democracy, are pro-Western, even like the United States. It is the only country that actually went into the streets and lit candles on 9/11. It is the only country that the United States hates and is an adversary of that didn't take part in 9/11. All America's allies took part in 9/11. So there's so much craziness here that
Can I just say something? And the Trump administration has tried to accuse Iran of being involved in 9/11. I mean, that's, you know, they're just rewriting the narrative.
But it's huge that if they try to do that, it is the same narrative that they did with Iraq, right? Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11. No, he wasn't. Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. No, he didn't. But we still went to war. This is what you all have to look out for, the narrative that's coming, if it does come, if they start to go into this sort of, you know, build up to whatever they might do next.
So let's make a really complex piece of geopolitical three-dimensional chess more complex by introducing the Israeli-Palestinian question into the context, because it's not unconnected. And there is a peace plan being launched today, or some version thereof, by Jared Kushner. You can't make the stuff up. So I guess I wanted to ask again how that prism should, I mean, how this recent conflict both influences this, or how the actions are influenced by it, in terms of particularly the US's conduct.
I can have a shot at
shot at that. I think one of the interesting elements that's come out under the Trump administration, which impacts the Israeli-Palestinian file, is this alignment between the Gulf actors, the GCC actors, and Israel on this animosity towards Iran, pushing them closer to essentially compromise on other areas, which may include the Palestinian file. We'll see. I mean, the official line from Saudi Arabia and other GCC states is that they are not happy with Kushner's plan. At least this is, you know, behind closed doors. They don't see this as settling the issue. Most, I think, analysts in Europe, at least, that are looking at this issue are fearing that the Trump peace plan may actually lead to a state of apartheid in Israel in terms of the rights of the Palestinians. But there is this emergence of, you know, back channel, even open channel diplomacy now happening between Arab countries and Israel that wasn't happening prior to the Trump administration. And I think the focus here and the overlap here is on Iran and the pushback strategy against Iran.
I'm going to ask one more question, then I'm going to turn it over to all of you. There's a kind of smaller, but I think no less consequential issue against the backdrop of all of this. And this is, in a world of where technology is lowering the barriers to nuclear proliferation, what the tearing up of the nuclear deal does, not just for Iran, and I'd like to dwell for a moment on if you're in the middle of Iran and you having painstakingly negotiated a deal which you dragged your country into it, that, you know, a sign of a good deal is that everybody is unhappy with it, but everybody agrees to abide by it. That having been torn up almost as soon as the ink dries. And if you are India, Pakistan, Saudi, North Korea, if you look back at the experience of Libya, and you say, are my interests served by cutting a deal to denuclearize? Or are my, you know, or are these deals never worth the paper that they're written on? And the moment that you sign these deals are the moment that you either get regime change, Gaddafi, or they get torn up, but in the process, you get weakened and humiliated. Isn't there a real problem that we'll never get the Iranians to sign up again to a similar deal, or it'll be much harder? And the geopolitical consequence of this is going to be that denuclearization as a project is going to be set back.
I'm happy to try that. I mean, in theory, yes, you're right. And, you know, earlier when you asked me about problems with the deal, there were also problems with the deal for Iran. And I think that it's worthwhile to just mention what the problems were. Iran, although it offered to negotiate everything with the Obama administration, and the Obama administration said no, the deal was constrained in returning investment to Iran because Iran remained under significant sanctions still from the United States. Not all of the sanctions were removed. And the threat of snapback sanctions continued to always loom over every business deal between private sector companies and Iranian companies. So that constrained investment for Iran. And today, now, both the Trump administration and the Iranians, and it might seem laughable after this discussion to talk about a new deal, do say that if there is going to be a new deal, it must be a treaty. I know the U.S. has withdrawn from the treaty with Russia. Nevertheless, the Trump administration would like to make a better deal by securing a treaty through congressional approval. And congressional Republicans and Democrats have to be on board for that to happen. So this is something that Iran would insist on redressing if and when it comes to the negotiating table.
But let me pause on that. Is there a plausible scenario of a new treaty emerging from this particular context? Because that would in some way, you know, make it
even more complex and more interesting to think about.
So I realize, again, in the context of this discussion and in the context of where we are on January 28th, it seems really hard to look at a new deal coming to fruition, particularly this year. But I do think that there is a small window of possibility, but it requires significant diplomacy from the international community, and it requires a back channel to be developed between Washington and Tehran, the continuation of some of the positive moves we saw last year, in terms of tweeting back and forth between the two capitals, and the exchange of prisoners, the dual nationals that are currently being held in Iran, in return for the long list of Iranian nationals being held in the United States. There is a very small window between now and November to build on or to rebuild on that momentum. But, you know, in order for that to happen, there has to be a lot of work behind the scenes.
So are we tiptoeing up to a conduit moment? And I want to ask you, I mean, you feel free to take it in a different direction, Christian, but...
What's a conduit moment?
A conduit moment is that there's a positive solution to something that's very bleak.
Oh, okay.
And so I'm grasping for it because it's been hard work this morning. I'm trying to understand the contours of that deal. What would it be that both sides would possibly agree to that would be better than the prior deal, and what's the plausible path to it? Because if we know A and B, that seems to be a project worth working for, and I'm told that there may be a meeting or a conversation with Jared Kushner later on, which...
Oh, no, yeah. No, so I'm interviewing Jared this afternoon.
Then we have,
like
the,
around,
we have the deal. There no, we know.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So, no, I'll ask him that. I will ask him, actually, is there any... And he won't answer necessarily, but is there any... Do you see any window of opportunity here? And what is that window? So I will definitely ask him that. But I think that, you know, in response to what you asked and what Eli and Sanam just said, first of all, it needs really great third-party assistance to get the US and Iran back together again. But we've seen that because Macron actually did do it. All through the summer, he in fact even brought Javad Zarif to the G7 in France. He had Trump there. They had a kind of a sort of a deal maybe that the United States and the community would give Iran something like $15 billion to stabilize, you know, and try to stop the hemorrhage while they try to get to a new deal. Anyway, it didn't work for all sorts of reasons. Then to your question, I mean, of course a nuclear deal is worthwhile. Of course it is. This nonsense should not mean that people should go tearing up their nuclear deals. I mean, come on. If the United States could have a nuclear deal and arms control with the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War, and it kept the world, you know, from going to nuclear war, then of course nuclear deals are worthwhile. And they do work. And this one did work for the, you know, the 2 years that it was in, at least it worked for the West. Iran never got all the sanctions properly lifted, and it never got the global banking system to actually do what it had to do under the deal, because they were always afraid of it, precisely this happening, and snap back sanctions. So I think, you know, a moment has to be a moment of good faith. Because a negotiation, and this is what I'm afraid President Trump, because of his experience in his history of real estate negotiations, I mean, look, I'm not an expert, but he seems to be a zero-sum game kind of guy. I win, you lose. That's the definition of a negotiation. That's what it seems to be for President Trump. But a deal to be struck by two very powerful countries in different ways, or anybody, has to be a win-win. It has to be a win-win. And that's why Iran, even though, in my opinion and in their opinion, may have lost a little bit in this deal with the West because they had to ring-fence their programs, they could portray it as a win-win. And unless the Trump administration is prepared to do that, I don't know.
So what's the win-win?
Well, I mean, there has to be a quid pro quo, right? And the reason why Macron failed in his attempt back in September was because there was a problem with sequencing of who would take the first step. And this goes
pathetic
back to the zero-sum mentality of the Trump administration. Even though they are clearly the stronger party at this moment, they're not willing to give an inch in terms of sanctions easing first. And I think an important dynamic to remember, particularly about Iran, whether it was prior to the Islamic Republic or now, is in foreign policy, there is a concept of dignity. And it will be incredibly difficult for President Rouhani to go to a meeting with Trump without having something to come back with. And it becomes even more difficult now that Trump is not only associated with the downfall of the nuclear deal, but with the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. So I'm afraid my analysis is that till November, we're not going to see any major opening, bar perhaps some sort of a detainee exchange between the two sides, which will be a good thing, and both sides should progress with that. But Iran will want to guarantee that, A, they're going to deal with Trump as a second-term president, and B, they're going to need to see some sort of flexibility on the economic package that is currently being blocked by the U.S. administration.
Salam, I'm going to literally give you the last word, and then we're going to go. I'm still, because I have a sense you have more to give on this point. And so if there are four elements on the deal, there's the denuclearization, there's Iran's role in the region and its support of proxy actors, there's the ballistic missile program, and there's the carrot, which is the return of the lifting of sanctions and the return of Iran to the world's economy. The first one, I think we know how to denuclearize. The mechanics are done. I don't think there's much interesting to say there. The other three have to be offered and synchronized and sequenced. So who gives in what way in this context that makes that possible? Because my sense is that's the big picture deal, right?
Yes, you're right. Something I've worked on quite a bit at Chatham House. It's very hard to see the full grand bargain coming to fruition anytime soon. And there's a reason why it didn't come to fruition last time, because the regional issues are so pervasive and actually not solely about Iran. They very much involve regional interference by multiple countries, regional ballistic missile proliferation by multiple countries, proxy support not just by Iran, but also by the United Arab Emirates, the Qataris. I mean, it's a really complex, convoluted problem. So I think a JCPOA 2.0 can be negotiated. You can extend the sunsets. You can impose more restrictions on the Iranian nuclear program in exchange for more sanctions relief. You can even get the Iranians to probably agree to what they already have agreed nominally, not to pursue a long-range ballistic missile program, which is what the Americans are concerned about. But obviously, it's going to not really handle the issue of ballistic missiles in the region. But I think as part of that deal, there has to be a commitment by Iran, by the United States, by the P4 plus one, by the regional actors to come together in a very protracted regional engagement. Because without that, the regional issues can't be unlocked. And you know, that remains the crux of the problem.
Thank you so much for listening to this live episode of Conduit Conversations. I hope you found the conversation as thought-provoking as we did in the room. Don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform to be the first to hear upcoming episodes. If you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to leave a rating and review so that more people can discover our guests and their extraordinary work. Please also visit theconduit.com, where you can find more information on The Conduit and our community of changemakers.